And now it's my pleasure to introduce our 2024 Goldman Berlin Lectureship speaker, Dr. Devin Stahl. Dr. Stahl is an associate professor of religion in the Department of Religion at Baylor University, an adjunct associate professor at the Baylor College of Medicine, where she specializes in disability theology, bioethics, and visual arts within medicine. She completed her doctorate in philosophy in healthcare ethics from St. Louis University and holds a Master of Divinity from Vanderbilt University. A trained hospital chaplain and a practicing clinical ethicist, she is an experienced bioethics educator who teaches undergraduate and graduate students in religion, as well as medical students. The author of four books, Dr. Stahl explores themes ranging from disability to bioenhancement to theology and illness narratives. She has received grant funding for her research, including an active project at Baylor on theological inquiry and Christian ethics through psychological science training. In addition to presenting widely nationally and internationally, Devin co-hosts the Bioethics for the People, a podcast that explores the ethical implications of new technologies and scientific discoveries. And it's currently in its fifth season on a streaming platform near you. More personally, Devin is a trusted scholar with integrity who I've worked with extensively over the years and is quickly becoming a leader in the fields of clinical ethics, Christian bioethics, and disability ethics. We're very lucky to have her with us this morning. Would you please help me welcome my colleague and friend, Dr. Devin Stahl.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for that really generous introduction. Thank you all for being here at this early hour. And so both the folks in the room and also the folks who are able to attend virtually. Thanks to both the Goldman and the Berlin families and to both Drs. Berlin who are here virtually. I hope you enjoy this presentation. So today I want to talk about anti-ableist healthcare and what disability ethics can teach us about caring for people with disabilities in healthcare. This is a topic that's really my passion project, both because I teach disability ethics and bioethics, and because I'm an MS patient. So I've had a lot of experience both as a patient and as a clinical ethicist, having encounters with physicians, sometimes really good, sometimes not so great, around disability. And I have lots of friends with disabilities who have many stories to tell me about their experiences in healthcare. And I think we can all be doing better by our patients. Just a few objectives for our time together. I want to understand some of the health disparities that people with disabilities experience. Distinguish between different models of disability. This is what disability ethics is trying to teach us about how it is we even understand disability and how that would affect our practices in healthcare. And then identify some more concrete anti-ableist practices that we can all be engaging. So first, why should we care about disability, or why should we focus on disability? So you're here and you saw the title of the talk, so hopefully you're already invested in this topic. But in case you're not quite yet, the first thing I want to say is that this might seem obvious, but people with disabilities are a really significant minority in the US. According to the CDC, we make up 27% of the population. That's 61 million people in the US have at least one disability, making us the largest minority group in the US. And as you can imagine, this population is just growing. About 50% of people over the age of 65 have at least one disability. And as our population ages, that number is only going to increase. If you think about the neighborhood you live in, about one in three households will have at least one person with a disability living in that household. So lots of people in our hospital system and lots of people in our neighborhoods. And disability is, of course, intersectional. Rates of disability are higher for ethnic and racial minorities in our country, people who have lower socioeconomic status, and people living in rural areas. So if any of these demographics are your patients, or you care about any of these populations, you have to care also about disability. And of course, we know from lots of good empirical work that people with disabilities in our communities experience significant health disparities. And this is, I'm gathering a lot of this data from an NIH report that came out last year, which you can see here on the screen. I encourage you to look at it to get more of this. I've just cherry-picked some of the studies that they highlight in this report. But people with disabilities are far more likely than the non-disabled to report that they experience fair or poor health, 40% versus right around 10%. So they are not happy with the state of their health. And part of this is because they're much less likely to receive preventative care, including really essential care like mammography, pap smears, dental visits. I just saw a study from the Special Olympics that said when the athletes gathered for the last Special Olympics tour, they were all given physical exams and almost half of them had obvious tooth decay. So people are not being taken care of. They're not getting the kinds of preventative care that they need. And as a result of not getting the right kinds of preventative care, people with disabilities are much more likely to die from things like cancer. This makes sense if you're not getting your annual screenings, you're not catching cancer quite as quickly. There's also lots of studies on maternity care for women with disabilities who have pretty horrific stories at times, but they're not getting the kinds of anesthesia they need. They're not sort of seen as requiring pain reduction. So they're not as likely to get the kind of quality care that they need while giving birth. And they're much less likely to have regular healthcare providers, which means they have lots of unmet needs. Part of this is cost. If you belong to a class of folks with lower socioeconomic status, it's more difficult to get that kind of care. But as I'll show you in a moment, people with disabilities also they can experience a lot of stigma in our healthcare system, making them less wanting to go to see a doctor. And we know that people with disabilities experience significant barriers to accessing medical care. So they're more likely to be uninsured or underinsured. This became a little bit better with the passage of the ACA, but it's still the case that people with disabilities are less likely to be insured. And they're less likely to get timely, high-quality care due to a lack of accessible medical facilities and examination equipment. So exam tables that don't move, weight scales that can't accommodate a wheelchair, mammography that can't also move down to a wheelchair, as well as a lack of interpreters and individualized accommodations. So as you'll see in just a minute, healthcare providers typically don't know what is required of them under the ADA. And so they aren't as knowledgeable about the kinds of accommodations that they're expected to provide. There's a really classic study in which researchers called various clinics asking if they would take on a new patient in a wheelchair, and about 20% right off the bat said, "We can't accommodate you at all. This is not a place for you." Another 20% said, "I think we can," but when asked, they said, "We actually don't have any accessible medical equipment, so we actually can't take you as a patient." So right off the bat, about 40% of clinics just won't accept any patients who use a wheelchair. So you can see how difficult it might be for somebody to access healthcare if that's sort of the state of our system. And of course, people with disabilities are much less satisfied with the medical care that they do receive. They don't have access to care. They experience significant stigma. They can't get into the doctor's office. And then communication with their physicians can also be difficult. Lisa Iazzoni, a researcher out of Harvard, has done a lot of this work, and she has a fairly recent study that showed that physicians just don't understand their legal responsibilities toward people with disabilities under the ADA. So about 36% said they knew little to nothing about their legal responsibilities under the ADA. 71% incorrectly identified who determines a reasonable accommodation. 21% cannot identify who pays for reasonable accommodations. And 68%, this is a huge number to me, felt that they were at risk for an ADA lawsuit, right? So they don't know what the ADA requires and then are fearful that they could be sued as a result of that. So we should all be more knowledgeable, it seems, about what the ADA requires of us in terms of accommodating our patients with disabilities. And in another study of about 800 physicians, Iazzoni and her colleagues found that there's still a lot of ableist attitudes around disability. 82% of physicians that she surveyed reported they believe that people with significant disabilities have a worse quality of life than non-disabled people. And this is despite decades of evidence showing that people with all kinds of disabilities rate their quality of life the same as non-disabled people. Decades and decades of this evidence has just simply not changed physician attitudes around disability. 82%, that's a huge number. Only 40% of the physicians felt like they could provide the same quality care to their patients with disabilities as their non-disabled patients. Does not inspire a ton of confidence. And just 56% strongly agree that they welcome patients with disabilities into their practice. We'd like to see that number much, much higher. Sometimes we call this in disability studies the disability paradox. Paradox is a funny word here, but it's just to say when you survey people with disabilities and ask about their quality of life, they rate it quite high. This does not seem to break through to the general public. The general public also seems to think that disability lowers quality of life, but it's even worse amongst healthcare providers. And we believe that there is a link between attitudes around disability and quality of care. If you believe that your patient at baseline just has a worse quality of life, you're less likely to treat them as aggressively as you might somebody that you thought had a higher quality of life. So now that I'm 8-ish slides in, I want to ask, what are we even talking about when we talk about disability? Disability has a kind of heterogeneity problem, by which I mean we are talking about a huge group of people, 61 million people, who have all sorts of different embodiments, different minds. And we lump them all together under this thing we call disability, which is a fairly modern way to think about this category. There was no such word as disability in, say, like the ancient world, right? There were different conditions, but they weren't all lumped together under this one definition. And there's a lot of historical reasons for this, partly to do with medicine, that we have this kind of now huge grouping of people with very different kinds of bodies that we're saying all have these things we call disabilities. We know that disabilities can be physical, they can be intellectual, they can be developmental, they could be psychological. You can get them genetically or congenitally, or you can acquire disabilities. We like to say in the disability world, like, we will all be disabled at some point if we're lucky to live that long, right? So these disabilities can be chronic, they can be temporary, they can be static, they can be intermittent, and they can be progressive, right? This is a lot of different ways that people individually will experience a disability. So we have to ask at some point, I think, what does a person with bipolar disorder and MS and schizophrenia and Down syndrome and paraplegia, what do all those people have in common? We're saying they all have this thing called disability, but it's not necessarily easy to know what connects all of these folks or what we mean when we say that, given this heterogeneity. So the way that disability scholars want us to think about disability is that instead of having a definition, definitions are inherently kind of limiting. All those embodiments, if we have one specific definition, will almost always exclude some people or include people that we don't naturally think of as having disability. So rather than definitions, we might instead want to think about disability as models of disability. What are the different ways we can frame what it is that unites all folks with disabilities? So one way we might do this is what is called the charity model of disability. And I have this comic in the corner, if you can see it, where a reporter, he's holding out a microphone, is asking a guy in a wheelchair, "Can I ask you what it's like to be a tragic but brave member of society?" And the guy responds, "Only if I can ask what it's like to be such a, excuse my language, patronizing bastard." And it's funny, but there are lots of people in our society, I'm sure you've met some, who think of disability as kind of a tragic or unfortunate circumstance, requiring good, able-bodied people to extend charity to help these poor, pitiable folks. If you are of a certain age where you remember telethons, this was pretty prominent sort of model of disability under a telethon. You would have kind of a sad, usually child paraded on a stage. They would tell you a sort of sad story about their life and then ask that you donate money either for a medical cure for their condition or so that they could go to summer camp and be like other kids. I encourage you to look up some of these stories. A lot of the kids who were part of these telethons, of course, grew up and looked back at their experience and said, hey, I was used as an object for this organization, and I now really resent the ways in which I was portrayed as this kind of pitiable, Tiny Tim figure for the purposes of this organization. But that charity model, I think, telethons still somewhat exists, not quite as prominent as they once were, but there still is a kind of attitude that of the charity model. Sometimes in disability studies, we call this inspiration porn, where people with disabilities do everyday things and are sort of lifted up as like, isn't this amazing? Isn't it amazing that this guy left his house this morning? Isn't it amazing that the kid with Down syndrome got asked to the prom? Isn't it amazing that the kid with autism was able to kick the football at the football game, right? That kind of everydayness of disability is lifted up as inspiring, of course, for non-disabled people. And I think that can create a lot of resentment. This is contrasted with a different framing of disability, which is often called the medical model. The medical model sees disability as a kind of biological individual deficit that can be corrected or at least ameliorated by medicine. And so thus the medical model, which isn't to say that medicine invented this model per se or that all medical professionals hold this model, but rather that we live in a quite medicalized society in which medicine can dominate the narrative around disability. The problem with this kind of framing, according to disability scholars, is that disabilities tend to be pathologized and almost always seen as bad. And disability can become conflated with suffering and the need for cure. Sometimes we call this the disability ableist conflation, where I'm sure you've seen this, where you go, especially in like kind of public health discourse, such and such can lead to disability, suffering, and death, as if all these things kind of get lumped together, as if disability always causes a kind of suffering, which would be a mistake, of course, because not all disabilities cause suffering. So disability scholars, many want us to think differently about disability rather than an individual biological deficit as a kind of social construction. So disability is partly or primarily a social construction made possible by architecture, attitudes, and social norms of modern society. Meaning something like, you know, it's not paraplegia that disables a person, it's a lack of ramps into a building, right? The architecture of our buildings can disable people from full participation. Our attitudes and stigma around disability disables people from full participation. And our norms of society can do the same. So it's a kind of whole society thing rather than the problem being the individual. So there are, of course, certain natural or physical characteristics that fall under this category we call disability. But what unifies disability is not those, as we said, these kind of heterogeneity, these different kind of embodiments. What unifies disability is the social features of our environment, not those natural characteristics. So fixing disability then is not about fixing individual bodies, but about fixing our social structures and our attitudes. What we need is better accommodation and better integration, and not necessarily just hyper-focus on the individual embodiment of a person. Of course, the critique is often something like, there are some disabilities that probably cannot be easily accommodated. Meaning, if I live with chronic pain, no amount of like good infrastructure or positive attitude is gonna make that easy in my life. So there might be some things that are just, even in a utopian world, this is still going to be a difficulty for a person. But that doesn't mean that all disabilities are quite like that. We also want to acknowledge that lots of people with disabilities don't want things like cures. They're not focused on curing their disability. But some people with disabilities do. They would rather not have their disability, and they want good access to medicine to either cure that disability or at least make it easier to live with that disability. So all that being true, I think we can still say there's a big part about disability that really is social. It's not merely about individual biological characteristics. It's about a social environment that accommodates certain bodies really well and other bodies not so well. I really like these illustrations. They were done for taxi cab drivers in the UK, but are often used in disability studies because they're just like, everybody loves a cartoon. But it just sort of illustrates, I think nicely, the differences between a medical model and a social model. In the medical model, you'll see this sort of unhappy looking man. He's wearing a shirt that says the problem, and the problem is all pointing at him. And they wanted artists of this want to show us that impairments and chronic illness can pose real difficulties, but they're not the main problems of disability. The traditional medical view shows us that disability is caused by these physical, mental, sensory impairments, that the individual is impaired and therefore the individual is the problem, and that the focus is therefore on the medical profession, which has been tasked with curing or alleviating the effects of those impairments. This is then contrasted with this social model in which the person is no longer, you know, doesn't have the t-shirt that says the problem. Instead, the problem is pointing outward. The problem is the barriers that society implements on this person. And those social barriers can include environment, which is inaccessible. So our buildings, our services, our language or communication around disability. It can be attitudes around disability, so our prejudices, our stereotypes, our discrimination, or it can be our organizations, which are often, I work in academia and in hospitals, inflexible, and have procedures and practices that just cannot accommodate certain people with disabilities. So since, especially the ADA, there has been movement in some organizations that think about disability toward incorporating elements of the social model into their definitions. So whenever I see a definition of disability, I always have to first ask, who is this for and why, right? So the ADA, of course, is going to define disability in service of rooting out disability discrimination, which is why it has this sort of interesting definition of physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major activities of the individual, or having a record of that, or even being regarded as having one of those. So it is still disability discrimination if you discriminate against somebody because you think they have a disability, even if they don't actually have a disability. The CDC will define disability as a condition of the body or mind, which they call an impairment, that makes it difficult for the person with the condition to do certain activities, which they call activity limitations, and interact with the world around them, which are participation restrictions. So you see a little bit of this social modeling coming in here because there's a recognition of like participation, but mostly these are still medical models of disability. They hyper-focus on the problem being the individual's body problem. And then that is what restricts participation in society. So instead of sort of big definitions, I thought, what's another way we can show the differences between these models? So I think a lot about autism. So anyone who was diagnosed on the autism spectrum in the last few years under the DSM-5 would have seen kind of stuff like this. And this is, of course, quite abbreviated. But you get diagnosed because you have persistent deficits in social communication and interaction across multiple contexts, deficits in social emotional reciprocity, restricted repetitive movements of behavior, interests, or activities, right? So these are all sort of this kind of criteria hyper-focuses on the problem of the individual. I have a very good friend who has a son with autism, and he was doing his IEP, this individualized education programming with the school, and he has to fill out a survey. One of the questions is, does your child hyper-focus on things that are annoying to other people, e.g. dinosaurs, bugs? And it's just, it's both quite sad and quite funny because some people's hyper-focus is annoying, right? bugs, dinosaurs, I guess, are annoying kinds of hyperfixations. My hyperfixations can be maybe better socially accommodated. I hyperfocused on this lecture for quite a long time. Nobody was like, you're annoying us. Maybe they thought it, but they didn't say it out loud. But you know, it's pigeonholing these things as like, this is a problem, right? Obviously these are problems. I wanna contrast this with the way that autism speaks about autism. And I'll say right off the bat, a very controversial organization, in part because they don't often let people with autism speak. It's often people who are caregiving that are speaking on behalf. So it's somewhat ironic. But they write from their website, we know that there is not one autism, but many subtypes, most likely influenced by a combination of genetic and environmental factors. Because autism is a spectrum disorder, each person with autism has a distinct set of strengths and challenges. The ways in which people with autism learn, think, and problem solve can range from highly skilled to severely challenged. Some people with ASD may require significant support in their daily lives, while others may need less support and in some cases live entirely independently. So you see they're casting a different sort of valence on autism. It's a spectrum disorder. They say things like strengths as well as challenges. So acknowledging that there are some things about autism that actually provide strengths to a person. Still fairly medicalized in its language. So in contrast to that, there has been a hashtag campaign, I think in large part because of Autism Speaks, that just wants to sort of get out into the world what it's actually like to be autistic. And so here are just some of the quotes I found on social media that I thought were really telling. So the first one says, all my sensory activity is all me. I often wonder why some of society would want to cure my love for life and change us like them into someone not sensory alert or someone who doesn't experience intense feelings. Neurotypical people must be numb in comparison to those to us who are neurodivergent. And so the contrast is a positive contrast. There's no pretentiousness with many autistic people. We say what we mean and we mean what we say. Often people find that refreshing. There's a real strength in that. I'm autistic, which means everyone around me has a disorder that makes them say things they don't mean, not care about structure, fail to hyperfocus on singular important topics, and have unreliable memories, drop weird hints, and stare creepily into my eyeballs. Right, so it's everyone around me that is disordered. The things that make me autistic are really positive social contributions. And I think it's meant to be a little bit funny, but also meant to say there's a kind of pride for a lot of people in the way that they experience autism. There is no sort of outside of autism, but they see these sort of things that are often called deficits under the DSM-5 as being actual strengths in their everyday life. And that neurodivergency is not something that we should be fearful of, but that is something that's positive for our community and positive for individuals. So I want to place some of this kind of big theoretical work into particular ways in which we might then think about how we provide healthcare to people with disabilities. And I'm just going to, these are all articles I've written fairly recently where I'm thinking about how to apply this work in disability ethics to the kind of healthcare situation we're finding ourselves in. In the midst of the pandemic, you will of course all remember this, we were scrambling to write good hospital and state policies around scarce resources and crisis standards of care. A lot of states wrote these in 2012 because there was a fear of a bird flu epidemic that didn't actually come to fruition, but the CDC advised that all states should have a kind of crisis standards of care policies. And so when these started being implemented during 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, it became really clear really quickly to disability advocacy groups that some of these policies were explicitly discriminatory toward people with disabilities. You see the Alabama policy at the top of the screen, and I highlighted this, directed hospitals not to offer mechanical ventilator support for patients with severe or profound mental retardation. This is a word that has been banned by Rosa's Law way before this was written. So I can't believe that we're still using the R word, but so just to say, please don't use the R word. It is federally banned from using it in any kind of documentation. So moderate to severe dementia, severe traumatic brain injury. This also applies to children. So anyone who sort of fit into this category of intellectual disability or traumatic brain injury, just don't give them ventilators. So pretty explicitly categories of people that are meant to be protected under the ADA being called out as not then being able to receive ventilator support. On the bottom left, you'll see the Washington State Department of Health's ICU care screening, which incentivized hospitals to look at baseline functional status to consider whether or not people could get ICU care. And so urged hospitals to not put people in the ICU if they had loss of reserves and energy. I don't know what that means. I'm feeling that right now, but I think they mean something like chronic fatigue and disability. Physical ability, so consider people's physical ability at baseline to whether or not you want to let them in the ICU. Cognition, so intellectual disability and general health. Pretty kind of a little bit more veiled than the Alabama policy, but still clearly calling out categories of people of disability and saying they do not deserve the aggressive care in comparison to people who are not disabled. So a lot of us started tracking just all the states that came up before the OCR. So the Office of Civil Rights heard a lot of complaints from disability advocacy groups saying a lot of these policies are clearly like calling out categories of people with disabilities and saying that we should deprioritize them. And that seems to be a violation of the ADA. OCR, will you step in and tell them they have to revise their policies, which the OCR did. Sorry to say Oregon was one of those. Probably some of you had something, were instrumental in revising that policy. So I'd love to hear your stories. Texas also got called up. I didn't make it in here because we had, Texas is so big, we had Middle Texas and Northern Texas. But some of those were also put before the OCR. Lots of states had policies that had to be revised because they were clearly discriminatory. And this isn't to say that all disabilities then have to be treated equally, but that you have to do an individualized assessment of folks with disabilities before you can say that they wouldn't actually benefit from something like ventilator support in the ICU. This is pretty similar to some research I've been doing around organ transplantation. So as you might know, organ transplant centers are free to determine the criteria by which they'll provide solid organs to a recipient. A lot of them take IQ into account. IQ is not a contraindication for organ transplant, but a lot of centers will use IQ and disability status as an absolute contraindication for organ transplant. So Angie Wall in Texas has been doing some of this. Most, over 50% of transplant centers still consider intellectual and developmental disability, mild to severe, as a relative or absolute contraindication. That just sort of blows my mind. 71% of transplant physicians said they would automatically disqualify an adult with an IQ under 35 from receiving an organ. And they note in this paper, they think the actual number is even higher than that. There's a kind of course, social desirability bias that comes out when you survey people. You're like, do you discriminate? And they go, oh, no. Except with, so 78 or 71% were willing to say, yeah, absolutely. That number actually might be higher. But folks have done surveys just looking at the outcomes. When we do provide people with intellectual disabilities organs, solid organs, and it turns out that they do just as well by any metric you can imagine. So none of the available data suggests notable differences, early graft survival, patient survival, adherence to the post-transplant regimen, which is pretty exhaustive, as you know, their reported quality of life or improvement in functional status between the recipient with and without intellectual disability. So the burden of proof obviously is on these centers and these surgeons to say, I won't do it because people don't benefit, right? So the burden of proof ought to be on those who say we shouldn't be doing this. And so of late, a lot of states have been passing additional legislation to protect people with intellectual disabilities from not being discriminated against. However, I think the ADA already did that. So the ADA already sort of says we can't do this. We've been doing it anyway for the last 35 years. So hopefully new legislation might help in that area, but I'm not super convinced. I think we need to change our attitudes around disability. Another area that I've been focusing on is this idea of quality of life. I hear it all the time in the hospital. Quality of life often gets used as a way to sort of deprioritize people with disabilities from receiving intensive care. You might remember this case, it made national news. It was a big deal in Texas because it happened in Texas. Michael Hickson had experienced a TBI earlier in his life, was residing in a nursing home. He was blind and was a paraplegic, and he had some cognitive deficits, but was visited frequently by his wife and young children. And they said they had a meaningful relationship with him, that he was a hopeful person. He gets COVID-19, he's in the hospital, and his wife immediately goes, "I'm worried about him, about discrimination. He's Black, he's disabled. I worry that he is going to get deprioritized, that people aren't going to fight for him." So she wisely starts taping all the conversations with her physician. And at some point, the question of a ventilator comes up. They were not rationing yet at this point, but the physician says, "I think his quality of life is too low. I don't think we should put him on a ventilator." And she says, "What do you mean? Because he can't walk and he can't talk?" And the physician says, "Yes, that's why." So she, of course, has this on tape. She sends it to reporters. It becomes a national story. He is denied a ventilator and he does die. But it's pretty clear the quality of life was a big contributor to that. As I said before, people with disabilities tend to rate their quality of life as the same as non-disabled people. So this is a subjective judgment on the part or the behalf of the physician saying, "I just can't imagine," right? He's part of that 78% that just can't imagine that a person like Michael Hickson has a good quality of life. Therefore, he is less deserving of these aggressive treatments as other people. And of course, this happens all the time at the beginning of life. After the Dobbs decision, we got a lot of southern states implementing pretty restrictive abortion requirements. And part of what came with this was attempts by some states to say in the idea of enhancing reproductive choice, that there are some fetuses who are diagnosed with certain disabilities that maybe if that were the case, abortion should still be legal for these parents. So regardless, I think, of whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, what was problematic about this is that some, in Louisiana at least, the public health department put together this list of what they called medically futile unborn children, which is it struck me as a little bizarre because a person can't be futile, right? A condition can't be futile. Only certain kinds of treatment with a certain kind of goal can be futile. But they listed all sorts of conditions, many of which are actually not even anymore considered lethal. So it struck a lot of us as like potentially discriminatory toward the people who live with those conditions to be called medically futile. How can we continue to treat children with these conditions if we've already labeled them futile? You see a kind of tension between reproductive justice and disability justice in these cases. A group in Harvard did this nice table that I appreciate, is just talking about how do we think about these various biases that healthcare care professionals can hold and what kinds of effects they might have. One is an ineffectual bias. So if you think that people with disabilities possess lower levels of agency or competence, you might practice excessive paternalism. This happens, I think, quite a bit with people with intellectual disabilities. We assume they can't make their own medical decisions. We don't necessarily give them a capacity assessment. We just start talking to the other person in the room about them, right? I've seen this happen with people in wheelchairs. You just start talking to the person pushing the wheelchair instead of the person in it about that person. Very bizarre. There's some studies that show that a lot of physicians think that deaf people have a low IQ, right? Because they have trouble communicating with them. So there's these kind of biases where you might end up practicing excessive paternalism because you underestimate the capacity of the person you're speaking with. There's what's called a fragility bias. So clinicians perceive that patients with disabilities are suffering more than their non-disabled patients, and therefore you're more likely to treat them conservatively, right? Less aggressive treatment if you think if a person is suffering, you don't want to add more suffering on top of them. If you think that it's may or may not work, but we don't like it when people suffer. I think that's a good thing. But when we put that on people who aren't necessarily suffering, if we just assume it, we might be less likely to aggressively treat them. And then there's a kind of catastrophe bias. So clinicians assume that patients with disabilities have that low quality of life, and they're more likely to, you know, quote unquote, give up than they would for other non-disabled patients. Just some of the stereotypes and the biases that we might hold. So what can we do about it? There's a lot of things we can do, but just sort of as a short synopsis in the final couple of minutes I have, the first thing I would advise is avoid assumptions about your patients. What we learned, I think, during the COVID pandemic was that everybody needs a kind of individualized assessment. We have to assess our patient's decision-making capacity. If your patient is unconscious, okay, maybe you don't need to do it then, but anyone who has an intellectual disability or is having some cognitive difficulties, you still need to do the assessment. Don't assume that somebody can't make decisions. Ask your patients what they want. This is a lectureship in palliative care. I work on a palliative care team. This is kind of what we do all the time, but it is surprising how few clinicians will ask, what do you ultimately want? Right? What is important to you? Or what makes your life worth living? We might be surprised. I think a lot of us think that we couldn't possibly live in a state of severe disability, but it turns out a lot of us can. And understand your obligations under the ADA, whether you are under Title II or Title III, we should understand what it is that a reasonable accommodation is, who pays for it, how we can find those accommodations. Just a couple months ago, the federal government put out some standards for accessible medical equipment that they think all facilities should have to meet if they are funded by the federal or state government. So that won't apply to, of course, all hospitals, not this hospital, but we should all be sort of pushing to make sure that patients can even be seen and that we have the right kinds of equipment for them when they do go to the doctor. And so we should be proactively doing this, not waiting until we get a giant fine or get sued. This is, you know, this is the problem, of course, with the ADA, is it requires the person who was discriminated against to sue the institution doing the discrimination, which is really hard and expensive to do, which is why people don't win these suits very often. But we should be the ones to have the moral fortitude to sort of proactively ensure that people have access to the spaces in which they need vital healthcare. If you are looking for more resources in this area, there's some great stories, first-person narratives of people who feel like they've been discriminated against in healthcare. There's some Docs with Disabilities organizations that only 2% of physicians say that they have a disability, so it's a small group, but they need mentors. There's some great articles. If you want to know more about the history of the disability rights movement, I love the Crip Camp documentary, and there's a great one that just came out about nursing home residents in the pandemic. And Gretchen Berland, who I hope is listening, did a fabulous documentary called Rolling, where she just gives people in wheelchairs cameras to just show kind of what it's like to live in their position through several years, and she edits together. It's a really fabulous documentary that I would say that you should also look up. And then here's my exhaustive slides of of resources. But thank you very much.
Any questions for Dr. Stahl? So, Dr. Griffith?
It resonates a lot with me as someone who's doing a lot of work around weight discrimination and weight-centric care. So I have a good toolbox of things I say to people when I start seeing them go down a road that feels very like anti-fat and weight discriminatory. Do you have like a phrase that you can say or some things that you kind of pull out of your toolbox when you see people going down an ableist road where you don't want to set them back on their heels and make them feel really defensive, but you kind of want to raise your concern and see if you can reframe things for them?
Yeah. Oh man, I wish I had like a phrase that I always pull out. It's so, for me, dependent on my relationship with that person who's potentially doing the discrimination and how I think that they're going to react to me. So sometimes I want to be kind of funny, like, oh, well, we wouldn't want to discriminate against that person. Of course you're not doing that. Like sort of a, you would never do this. So I kind of secretly think you might be doing this. Or, you know, If they're a resident or a medical student, I think it's then just a little bit easier to say, hey, that's clearly just, we want to be really careful not to perpetuate disability discrimination in this instance. But of course, a trainee is going to hear that differently than sort of your attending physician. So for me, it kind of just depends on that relationship. I gave a similar talk to some medical students recently who said, we can't get our attending physicians to stop using the R word. Like, what should we do? And I was just like, holy moly. It's really hard to correct, of course, the person in the hierarchy above you. And so we were sort of talking through kinds of strategies on that, where one extreme is like, don't say anything. And the other extreme is like, call them out, embarrass them in front of everybody. Those are probably like extremes we don't want to go down. But I think just for me, it's gentle, like just, I'm the clinical ethicist in the room. So like, I have that kind of like moral clarity that I'm trying to bring to situations. Sometimes people appreciate that, sometimes they don't. Like, oh, let's just be really careful. We wouldn't want to perpetuate disability discrimination. That would be illegal. I find that many clinicians are more afraid of the law than they are about my moral judgment. It's a mistake. You should be just as afraid of my moral judgment, but it is illegal, right? This is baseline stuff. Baseline, we should not be just illegally discriminating. We are in Catholic healthcare. We should rise much higher. We should have a much higher bar than not breaking the law, right? Yeah, thank you.
Devin's also very vehement against other ethicists with ableist notions, right? You just call us out and strip us down to our core.
Unsurprisingly, there are a lot of clinical ethicists who also hold these biases. Yeah.
I think I saw another hand room before we go to the chat.
My name is Kristen. I'm a medical student working with the hospital team. So my concern is, particularly in a clinical setting, getting a good physical exam. I know that one of the things that tends to happen is like people don't get their patients up out of the wheelchair. But do you have any other suggestions on making sure we're not missing something because of those assumptions?
Yeah, good. So that's a huge one. There have been quite a few lawsuits now because people weren't taken out of their wheelchairs to do a physical exam and they had horrible bed like sores, right? So and that weren't caught. So if you're not getting people out of their wheelchairs for that physical exam, there's a lot of stuff that you can miss. Or I was reading some stories about folks who were like, oh, they did help me get out of my wheelchair onto the exam table and then forgot about me. And I sat in that room for another hour because nobody helps me back into my wheelchair, which is like just surprising, but not surprising. So that's a huge one. But also like the equipment you need, like the mammography machines are really important because disabled women are like so much more likely to die of breast cancer without that. It's also assuming, there's a lot of times people talk about their physicians assuming they don't have sex because they're disabled, which is also kind of wild, both physical and intellectual disabilities. So asking about those things is really important. Don't assume anything about the sexual activity of the person that you're talking with. And a lot of it's communication. So both ASL interpreters, which can't be done over the phone, like, right, a lot of translation can be done over the phone, but of course ASL cannot. So having good ASL interpreters is really like vital for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And supported decision making. So later this afternoon, I'm going to talk about movements towards supported decision making, in which a person with an intellectual disability has a support person who's helping to sort of both translate in plain language what the doctor is saying, because physicians aren't often great about saying things that just everyday people can understand. But having that person as like kind of an advocate to bounce ideas off of is really vital for a lot of people with intellectual disabilities who can still make their own choices, but need somebody to support them in those decisions. So making sure that those folks, and Oregon passed a law to make sure that they're allowed into those spaces. Just fairly recently during the pandemic. So just making sure that we have the right kinds of advocates. So people can also be accommodations to support other people. So just like, I think being wide open about what is what we consider an accommodation. I think people think about equipment and that's really vital, but there are other things that can be accommodations as well.
So I'm going to go ahead and go to the chat here, and your penultimate slide had a paper that I think might help this this question in terms of, I really loved your talk, wanting to know about three takeaways that I could take back to my team. Maybe that third dot point there, or your version of what some key takeaways are to take back to teams. And I'm going to try to combine that also with any thoughts about improving preventative care, you know, for folks with disabilities. What kinds of strategies are recommended by disability advocates?
Do I remember exactly what Joel's three points are in this article? I think that they are avoiding the suffering conflation. So don't assume that all people with disabilities are suffering from their disabilities. Don't assume that all people with disabilities want a cure for their disability. That kind of, sometimes we call this the curative imaginary. They're like, oh, who wouldn't want a cure? I often actually get this question, which is like, if there was a magic pill that made your MS go away, wouldn't you take it? And if I say yes, they go, gotcha, you hate disability too. I'm like, whoa, that's a, people love that magic pill question. But that's not totally fair, because the reasons that MS are hard are both like physical and mental, but also social. And so if I could just make all that go away, that would be very nice and would make my life easier. But that doesn't mean that I can't have pride in my disability. So sort of talking about the complexities of that. And then just, I wish I remembered the third one more precisely, but I think it's sort of understanding how we frame disability under these models. So I think being more expansive about how we think about disability, asking about things other than just the physical and mental embodiment of our patients. So what are the things that make life hard outside of that? Do you have, and we should always be asking this, adequate transportation? How, I know so many people who get kicked out of their clinical practice, out of their clinic, because, or get fired as a patient because they just like couldn't get the van to get to their home on time to get to the clinic in time, right? So three strikes are out and nobody ever asked them about transportation. So I think these things are sort of, they're important for all of our patients. Lots of our patients struggle with transportation to the clinic, but just asking about it and how can we help make this easier for folks. For preventative care, I mean, you need to advocate for reforming our healthcare system. That's sort of a giant task, but we have not the worst possible healthcare system, but like second. Sorry, that's a joke. Bailey hates when I say that. It's just, we have a really messed up healthcare system when we're constantly trying to kick people out of their insurance, right? The ACA did a lot. When I was diagnosed with MS, my insurance company cut me off of all medications and like within 2 months. Right, because my medication was so expensive before the ACA, they were like, you met your cap, no more medication for you, which meant that I enrolled in a research study for 4 years of my life that had a placebo arm. So it's like, there was a real good chance that I was not getting treatment. Also a good chance that I could die of a heart attack. That was the other arm of it. People kept dying. And I was like, it's fine, because this is the only way I get medicine. That's not great. I don't want to go back to that. So I think it's important that we keep kind of the progress that we've made, but we need to expand it even further. So how do we, I go to the legislature, I advocate for certain things because they're always trying to pass laws that don't make sense to me. So how can we, I think we also have to be advocates for expanding healthcare to as many people as we possibly can.
Yeah, let's go maybe Dr. Perry and then.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. I'm a geriatrician caring for a lot of people with dementia and run into a myriad of all of the issues that you discussed. Any suggestions for managing the moral distress that all of us as clinicians run into as we hit all of these walls of how our system fails to accommodate or fails to consider the needs or the wants of our patients who don't look like the rest of the patient population?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks for doing the work that you do. It's so important. I'm doing a study right now where I'm interviewing patients with dementia to ask about who they'd want to make decisions for them. And it's just amazing how many of our hospitals won't let people pick a healthcare advocate because they have dementia, as if they don't know who loves and takes care of them. And what I find is that people are pretty articulate about who should take care of them because they're already the person, and they might actually not be the person in the statute hierarchy. So it's so important, the work that you're doing and advocating for these patients. I just think that it's a huge injustice on all sorts of levels, what we're denying people with dementia. We just had Stephen Post came to our campus last week, and he wrote this book called Caring for Deeply Forgetful People. and he thinks that this is a more lovely way to talk about dementia than the word dementia, that there are people who are deeply forgetful, but who are still valuable members of our society and need to be treated with dignity. Simply because you can't remember doesn't mean that you're any less worthy. So that is not answering your question, but just to say thank you for the work that you're doing. I think it's so important. I think that we just need to be more outspoken. I can't believe how many physicians don't speak out more about reforming our healthcare system. It's so vital. Like, what you see, people don't often see, right? We're all too beaten down. Yeah, yeah. You're too beaten down to continue to advocate. I will advocate for you. This is what we do for our loved ones with dementia, right? Like, I will continue to advocate for you even when it's hard, because I'm not doing that work every day and I appreciate what you're doing. So then maybe it's the job of us clinical ethicists, and I'm looking this way to continue to advocate, because these are really important issues. We have to reform a system. And as our population ages, this is gonna get worse and worse. We're seeing this in other countries, right? Look to Japan. It's a big problem when we have an aging population we're not taking care of, who are worthy of care. And as a Catholic institution, we should all get that. But thank you for that.
Claudia Leonard, primary care doctor and faculty. I want to follow up on the magic pill question, because mm-hmm. I can see myself stepping into a mess. So I feel like I would rather that I not have shoulder pain. Mm-hmm. But I'd be really annoyed if people defined me by my shoulder pain. So I'm wondering if there's a little bit of a middle ground where it's okay to say, I'd rather not have MS, or I'd rather not be in a wheelchair, but I don't want you to see me just as somebody who's in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
You know, without being discriminatory or mm-hmm. offensive, but still be able to acknowledge the reality that some things are hard.
Yeah.
And you might rather not have some suffering.
Yeah. I think what I'll, so there are certain kinds of disabilities for which, when I talk to people, they'll tell me, of course, sometimes my life is really difficult and I'd rather not experience it. But when I say that out loud, people go, see, disability is terrible. Right. And that's not the whole of their experience either, because there are many gifts that also come with that disability. And so the tension there is real. But when you say it to an audience for whom the automatic assumption is that it's terrible, you have to be really guarded about what you say is difficult in your life, because that will be used as a weapon against you. Right. So when you hear people sort of, I've been like romanticizing disability, it's because the dominant cultural narrative is so negative that, you know, you have to say something more positive, because you have to reveal that side of it too. So there are, of course, always two sides to this. But what our culture doesn't tolerate well, they love the like inspiration stuff, but they don't love the like disability pride stuff. It just baffles people, right? So I think we're not quite at the place yet where a lot of disabled people are willing to talk about the struggles, because they don't want it to be weaponized against them. And that is a sad state of our society, because we should all be able to talk about, you know, how our identities make our lives better and worse. And I just think that's really difficult at this moment, where there's so much stigma around certain identities.
Would you help me thank Dr. Devin Stahl?